Greetings. So, this evening we'll begin chapter 3 in the Yoga of Self-Perfection. This chapter is entitled The Psychology of Self-Perfection. And it was released on the 15th of February in 1919. A little more than a year later, Mira Risha would rejoin Sri Aurobindo in 1920. And in only a few months more, the Arya would cease publication. You'll remember that in January 1919, we saw the conclusion of the series on the Life Divine. So the first article that opened this issue of the Arya was Essays on the Gita, the Supreme Word of the Gita. It was the 31st essay in that series. So, the psychology of self-perfection. Essentially then, this divine self-perfection is a conversion of the human into a likeness of and a fundamental oneness with the divine nature, a rapid shaping of the image of God in man and filling in of its ideal outlines. Worth mentioning that we have analogs of this in the Veda. We have, of course, this is a built-in theme in many of the tantras. It is what is ordinarily termed sadrishya mukti, a liberation into the divine resemblance out of the bondage of the human seeming, or to use the expression of the Gita, sadharmya gati, a coming to be one in law of being with the supreme, universal, and indwelling divine. These are important concepts in the development of Indian spirituality occurring both in Vedanta and in devotional Vedanta, theistic Vedanta. Sadrishya, meaning having the same likeness. So a divine resemblance is an apt translation. The Gita here, I think the actual phrase is Mama Sadharmya Agataha. Coming to be one in law of being. It means identity of nature. Sadharmya, having the same dharma, the same law governing the being. So suggestive, of course, that there's an interpenetration. This is important, that the divine assumes the position of the human, descends, alights not simply upon the human, but into the human. The human aspires and becomes one in communion with the Supreme above. Hence, yoga. To perceive and have a right view of our way to such a transformation, we must form some sufficient working idea of the complex thing that this human nature at present is in the confused interminglings of its various principles, so that we may see the precise nature of the conversion each part of it must undergo and the most effective means for the conversion. How to disengage from this knot of thinking mortal matter, the immortal it contains, from this mentalized, vital, animal man, the happy fullness of his submerged hints of Godhead, is the real problem of a human being and living. So something within that has to be brought forward. And if we find that, we find fullness. Purnam adaha, purnam idam. We may come from that, but until we find that here, we haven't got the full fullness. So, a Godhead that is submerged in us, that can come out, that's the challenge of life. Not happiness. life develops many first hints of the divinity without completely disengaging them. Yoga is the unraveling of the knot of life's difficulty. So flashes in every part of the being, whether it's mind, vitality, or physicality, are promises of a coming fulfillment. But until we live in union with our true nature, in the supreme nature, our goal is unfulfilled. First of all, we have to know the central secret of the psychological complexity which creates the problem and all its difficulties. So he interestingly does not refer here to the psyche per se. But an ordinary psychology, which only takes mind and its phenomena at their surface values, will be of no help to us. It will not give us the least guidance in this line of self-exploration and self-conversion. Still less can we find the clue in a scientific psychology with a materialistic basis, which assumes that the body and the biological and physiological factors of our nature are not only the starting point, but the whole real foundation, and regards human mind as only a subtle development from the life in the body. So he has just kicked to the side the idealism of Berkeley and the realism of Locke. Good riddance. That may be the actual truth of the animal side of human nature and of the human mind insofar as it is limited and conditioned by the physical part of our being. But the whole difference between man and the animal is that the animal mind as we know it cannot get for one moment away from its origins, cannot break out from the covering, the close chrysalis which the bodily life has spun round the soul, and become something greater than its present self, a more free, magnificent, and noble being. But in man, mind reveals itself as a greater energy escaping from the restrictions of the vital and physical formula of being. Well, worth pausing here for a little anecdote, because under Sri Aurobindo's watchful gaze and under Mother's expert inner powers, they could take the occasional aspiring animal around them, be it dog or cat, not merely a human, woman, or man, and peer inside and tickle into wakefulness the psychic possibility and bring it forward and upwards and actually lift it skywards until it realized what it was in essence. Not only Mother and Sri Aurobindo, but Sri Ramana Maharshi had this power to also instill the sense of divinity in any living being open to it. There's the question. Can they be open? Is the aspiration keen enough? Is the desire to reach the next level of being sharp, flaming enough? And it can be done. So to say that they cannot get for one moment away from its origins, that's the general rule that Sri Aurobindo and the mother had that power. But even this is not all that man is or can be. He has in him the power to evolve and release a still greater ideal energy, which in its turn escapes out of the restrictions of the mental formula of his nature and discloses the supramental form, the ideal power of a spiritual being. In yoga, we have to travel beyond the physical nature and the superficial man and to discover the workings of the whole nature of the real man. In other words, we must arrive at and use a psychophysical knowledge with a spiritual foundation. And in fact, he reverses the two. You must have the spiritual foundation first, the Vedantic realization, and you have to pour it out actively in dynamic transformation of the being, which is a tantric practice, as he has said earlier. And again, still, he has not mentioned the psyche here. Obviously, in a few years, when Mother returns from France and takes up the grooming of the ashram, the nurturing of the spiritual development of the people living around Sri Aurobindo, the term psychic would grow in importance and become one of the dominant features of his revised psychology and yoga. Onwards. Man is in his real nature, however obscure now this truth may be to our present understanding and self-consciousness, we must, for the purposes of yoga, have faith in it, and we shall then find that our faith is justified by an increasing experience and a greater self-knowledge, a spirit using the mind, life, and body for an individual and a communal experience and self-manifestation in the universe. This is a wonderful sentence. It is not unique in spiritual literature. In mystical traditions around the world through all times, this is an insight. We'll find close to Sri Aurobindo's writing here, Rudolf Steiner saying roughly the same thing in Germany. This spirit is an infinite existence, limiting itself in apparent being for individual experience, sat. It is an infinite consciousness, which defines itself in finite forms of consciousness for joy of various knowledge and various power of being, chit. It is an infinite delight of being, expanding and contracting itself and its powers, concealing and discovering, formulating many terms of its joy of existence, even to an apparent obscuration and denial of its own nature, ananda. In itself, it is eternal sat-chit-ananda. But this complexity, this knotting up and unraveling of the infinite in the finite is the aspect we see it assume in universal and in individual nature. So there is an involution, the knotting up, and there's an unraveling, a loosing of the knot, a loosening of the knot, and that is evolution. Both above and below, both around and within. To discover the eternal Sat-Chit-Ananda, this essential self of our being within us, and live in it is the stable basis to make its true nature evident and creative of a divine way of living in our instruments, supermind, mind, life, and body, the active principle of a spiritual perfection. So again, Sri Aurobindo has as the basis of his positive life-affirming philosophy the concept of Sat-Chit-Ananda to the front. The supramental upon which we spend so much time speaking is a derivative expression of the absolute unity which is Sat-Chit-Ananda. But make no mistake, Sat-Chit-Ananda is the fundamental formula of all he writes about in The Life Divine and in the Synthesis of Yoga. He continues now with the instrumentality of the divine being, or potentially. Supermind, mind, life, and body are the four instruments which the spirit uses for its manifestation in the workings of nature. Might be worth underscoring that sentence, because if the supramental is conjoined with the other instruments, mind, life, and body, and all of them express the powers of nature, then nature is not simply the lower prakriti. It is nature with a capital N. It is a supernature, whether seen as para-prakriti or as prakriti. She is supreme. Because the supramental currently only exists there, in the Mahashakti, the divine nature. we're trying to bring it here, are we not? Supermind is spiritual consciousness, acting as a self-luminous knowledge, will, sense, aesthesis, energy, self-creative and unveiling power of its own delight and being. Mind is the action of the same powers, but limited and only very indirectly and partially illumined. Supermind lives in unity, though it plays with diversity. Mind lives in a separative action of diversity, though it may open to unity. Mind is not only capable of ignorance, but because it acts always partially and by limitation, it works characteristically as a power of ignorance. It may even, and it does, forget itself in a complete inconscience or nescience, awaken from it to the ignorance of a partial knowledge, and move from the ignorance towards a complete knowledge. That is its natural action in the human being, but it can never have by itself a complete knowledge. Mind cannot attain the Purnam. Supermind is incapable of real ignorance, even if it puts full knowledge behind it and the limitation of a particular working, yet all its working refers back to what it has put behind it, and all is instinct with self-illumination. It's lit by its own light. Even if it involves itself in material nescience, it yet does there accurately the works of a perfect will and knowledge. Supermind lends itself to the action of the inferior instruments. It is always there indeed at the core as the secret support of their operations. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the precision of the atomic workings. We wouldn't, well, he goes on to say, well, why should I anticipate what he's going to write in the next couple of sentences? But look back at the Life Divine to see how he describes the primary, secondary, and tertiary aspects of the supramental consciousness. And you see that even when the supramental stresses the possibility of diversity, populates it absolutely, the unity is not abrogated. The unity is still there, simply in the backdrop. Unity is always part of the supramental vision. So, supermind lends itself to the action of the inferior instruments. It is always there indeed at the core as a secret support of their operations. In matter, it is an automatic action and effectuation of the hidden idea in things. In life, its most seizable form is instinct, an instinctive subconscious or partly subconscious knowledge and operation. In mind, it reveals itself as intuition, a swift, direct, and self-effective illumination of intelligence, will, sense, and aesthesis. But these are merely irradiations of the supermind, which accommodate themselves to the limited functioning of the obscurer instruments. Its own characteristic nature is a gnosis, superconscient to mind, life, and body. Supermind or gnosis is the characteristic, illumined, significant action of spirit in its own native reality. So as the person of the spiritual nature above, in with a capital, all the derivative powers here, mind, life, and body, are secretly supported by it, because even the greater terms of Satchitananda, Sat and Chit, are expressed primordially through the supramental. So the possibility of returning to the expressed nature A paraprakriti is a potential because supramentality is already here at the core of each of these instruments. Lo, the one is everywhere and has never been absent for a moment, in time or in space. So he continues. We've just described mind now. Life is an energy of spirit, subordinated to action of mind and body, which fulfills itself through mentality and physicality and acts as a link between them. Life is an energy of spirit, which means it is chit-shakti. Chit ananda. So this is the chit, but chit is never absent power, shakti, or tapas, force. It has its own characteristic operation, but nowhere works independently of mind and body. Not here. Not in this world. It is the intermediary. It is what links the two. All energy of the spirit in action works in the two terms of existence and consciousness. For the self-formation of existence and the play and self-realization of consciousness, for the delight of existence and the delight of consciousness, that's the spirit in action. That is in the realm of chit. In this inferior formulation of being in which we at present live, the spirit's energy of life, derived from that, works between the two terms of mind and matter, supporting and affecting the formulations of substance of matter, and working as a material energy, supporting the formulations of consciousness of mind, and the workings of mental energy, supporting the interaction of mind and body, and working as a sensory and nervous energy. So above, below, and that interface between, all powered by prana. In fact, Sri Aurobindo, if you remember in The Life Divine, I believe, suggests that all movement in the cosmos is steered and directed by prana. Matter by itself is jada, inert. It requires prana to make it go. What we call vitality is, for the purposes of our normal human existence, power of conscious being emerging in matter, liberating from it and in it mind and the higher powers, and supporting their limited action in the physical life. So if mind stirs out from its material encasement, it's because life has delivered it. Life has forced it to evolve. Just as what we call mentality is power of conscious being awaking in body to light of its own consciousness and to consciousness of all the rest of being immediately around it, and working at first in the limited action set for it by life and body, but at certain points and at a certain height, escaping from it to a partial action beyond this circle. That's where sits the philosopher, thinking that he's superior to nature, that he is above life and body, and thinks that he can sit there as superior lord of it all until he discovers that, whoa, the encasement in which he has sat has crumbled because, indeed, mind is not the master. But this is not the whole power, whether of life or mentality. They have planes of conscious existence of their own, supraphysical, right? Other than this material level, where they are freer in their characteristic action, but they're not placed in matter. When they're in their own realm, they do not penetrate or express the possibilities in material existence. Matter or body itself is a living form of substance of spirit in which life and mind and spirit are involved, self-hidden, self-forgetful by absorption in their own externalizing action, but bound to emerge from it by a self-compelling evolution. So to go back to the imagery of the Tantra, you know, there may be the greater energy above, the power, the serpentine power of life as a superphysical force, superconscient force even, Mahakundali. But she descends, involves herself, and then at the base of matter sleeps as the Kundalini energy, which, when we strike upon it with conscious prana, stirs it to wakefulness, and she begins to rise and release all her powers that have been involved and moves upwards and upwards and upwards until boom, there you go. You've released yourself from involved consciousness into that thousand-petaled lotus, which is really a symbol of becoming aware of the infinite. You don't engulf the infinite, you don't swallow the infinite, but you become conscious of it. So, but matter too is capable of refining to subtler forms of substance in which it becomes more apparently a formal density of life, of mind, of spirit. Man himself has, besides this gross material body, an encasing vital sheath, a mental body, a body of bliss and gnosis. So all these inner envelopes that, in a sense, are part of our being but are typically unseen. But all matter, all body, contains within it the secret powers of these higher principles. Matter is a formation of life that has no real existence, apart from the informing universal spirit which gives it its energy and substance. Bhrigu, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, the whole lesson there is about this. As above, so below. The form fixes its shape for the life power. This is the nature of spirit and its instruments. But to understand its operations and to get it a knowledge which will give to us a power of leverage and uplifting them out of the established groove in which our life goes spinning, we have to perceive that the spirit has based all its workings upon two twin aspects of its being, soul and nature, Purusha and Prakriti. We have to treat them as different and diverse in power, for in practice of consciousness, this difference is valid. Although they are only two sides of the same reality, pole and pole of the one conscious being. Purusha, or soul, is spirit cognizant of the workings of its nature, supporting them by its being, enjoying or rejecting enjoyment of them in its delight of being. Nature is power of the spirit, and she is too working and process of its power, formulating name and form of being, developing action of consciousness and knowledge, throwing itself up in will and impulsion, force and energy, fulfilling itself in enjoyment. Nature is Prakriti, Maya, Shakti. And you'll remember that pregnant chapter in the Life Divine, one of the longest, if not the longest, chapters in the Life Divine, in which all these aspects of the power of being as nature, are addressed. If we look at her on her most external side, where she seems the opposite of Purusha, she is Prakriti, an inert and mechanical, self-driven operation, inconscient or conscient only by the light of Purusha, elevated by various degrees, vital, mental, supramental, of his soul illumination of her workings. If we look at her on her other internal side, where she moves nearer to unity with Purusha, she is Maya, will of being and becoming, or of cessation from being and becoming, with all their results, apparent to the consciousness, of involution and evolution, existing and non-existing, self-concealment of spirit and self-discovery of spirit. So Maya here is the measuring out of the infinite, defining the indefinable. Both are sides of one and the same thing, Shakti, power of being of the spirit, which operates whether superconsciously or consciously or subconsciously in a seeming inconscience. In fact, all these motions coexist at the same time and in the same soul as the spirit's power of knowledge, power of will, power of process and action. Jnana Shakti, Icha Shakti, Kriya Shakti. By this power, the spirit creates all things in itself, hides and discovers all itself in the form and behind the veil of its manifestation. Stunning though it be, Sri Aurobindo draws our attention to the fact that the Supreme Divine is all this at once, and something incapable of expression, incapable of being captured even in the positivity of being. It exceeds being itself. So this is where we'll put a bookmark and we'll finish this chapter, which is wonderful, is it not? The psychology of self-perfection. So, a passage from Savitri, and we could very easily, of course, read the passage about the he and she, but I thought we might do something from Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness, and start on page 76. A will, a hope immense, now seized his heart. And to discern the superhuman's form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights, aspiring to bring down a greater world. The glory he had glimpsed must be his home. A brighter, heavenlier sun must soon illume this dusk room with its dark internal stare. The infant's soul in its small nursery school, mid objects meant for a lesson hardly learned, outgrow its early grammar of intellect and its imitation of earth nature's art, its earthly dialect to god language change, in living symbols study reality and learn the logic of the infinite. The ideal must be nature's common truth, the body illumined with the indwelling God, the heart and mind feel one with all that is, a conscious soul live in a conscious world. As through a mist a sovereign peak is seen, the greatness of the eternal spirit appeared, exiled in a fragmented universe amid half-semblances of diviner things. These now could serve no more his regal turn. The immortal's pride refused the doom to live, a miser of the scanty bargain made between our littleness and bounded hopes and the compassionate infinitudes. His height repelled the lowness of earth's state, a wideness discontented with its frame, resiled from poor assent to nature's terms, the harsh contract spurned, and the diminished lease. Only beginnings are accomplished here. Our base's matter seems alone complete, an absolute machine without a soul. Or all seems a misfit of half-ideas, or we saddle with the vice of earthly form, a hurried, imperfect glimpse of heavenly things, guesses and travesties of celestial types. Here, chaos sorts itself into a world, a brief formation drifting in the void, apings of knowledge, unfinished arcs of power, flamings of beauty into earthly shapes, love's broken reflexes of unity swim, fragment mirrorings of a floating sun. A packed assemblage of crude tentative lives are pieced into a tessellated whole. There is no perfect answer to our hopes. There are blind, voiceless doors that have no key. Thought climbs in vain and brings a borrowed light, cheated by counterfeits sold to us in life's mart. Our hearts clutch at a forfeited heavenly bliss. There is provender for the mind's satiety. There are thrills of the flesh, but not the soul's desire. Here, even the highest rapture time can give is a mimicry of ungrasped beatitudes, a mutilated statue of ecstasy, a wounded happiness that cannot live, a brief felicity of mind or sense thrown by the world power to her body slave, or a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance. For all we have acquired soon loses worth, an old disvalued credit in time's bank, imperfection's check drawn on the inconscient. An inconsequence dogs every effort made, and chaos waits on every cosmos formed. In each success, a seed of failure lurks. He saw the doubtfulness of all things here, the incertitude of man's proud, confident thought, the transience of the achievements of his force. A thinking being in an unthinking world, an island in the sea of the unknown, he is a smallness trying to be great, an animal with some instincts of a god, his life a story too common to be told, his deeds a number, summing up to naught, his consciousness a torch lit to be quenched, his hope a star above a cradle and grave. And yet a greater destiny may be his, for the eternal spirit is his truth. He can recreate himself and all around, and fashion new the world in which he lives. He, ignorant, is the knower beyond time. He is the self above nature, above fate. Well, yeah. Namaste. Jai Ma.